Shalom, welcome everyone at the Dover Center, Kibbutz Ein Dor, here in northern Israel, for our retreat, 10-day retreat, starting today, May 17th, until May 27th, 2006. And it is very inspiring to see so many meditators here. Many of you are old and experienced meditators, but also we have some new meditators. And I'm particularly happy to be here at this kibbutz Ein Dor, because it's such a peaceful and quiet and beautiful place. And also much happiness and gratitude goes towards all those many people who've made this retreat possible. For one thing, Galia and Miles and Jerome, but also very instrumental Tovana Insight Meditation Society, and of course, without having the facilities here at this kibbutz, it wouldn't be possible to run the retreat. So much gratitude goes to this kibbutz Ein Dor. And I'm also very happy to have with me a group of volunteers, and they consist of Miles Kessler and Jérôme Parrin, and as kitchen manager Asaf, and then kitchen staff Dekel and Judith Lirat's Nama, who will come later on, and also Itai. And without their help, again, it would be impossible to run this retreat. Now, for the next 10 days, we will practice together the Pasna meditation in the tradition of the late Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma. The Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma was a famous and prominent meditation master, as well as a Buddhist scholar. And he was born in 1904 in the so-called Sekon village in northern Burma, and he started with his religious studies already at a very early age. He entered the local village monastery, became a novice at the age of six, and pursued his studies there, and later on he became a monk, as part of his studies, he also took interest in Satipatthana meditation, and he practiced under the so-called first Mingon Sayadaw, Mula Mingon Sayadaw, or root Sayadaw. And Mingon lies in the southern part of Burma. Mahasi Sayadaw was or excelled not only as a meditation master. He propagated this particular form of meditation not only in Burma but also outside of Burma. Many centers exist in Burma, over 300, and abroad there are plenty of meditation centers who follow his approach to Vipassana meditation. But apart from all of this, Mahasi Sayadaw played an important role during the Sixth Buddhist Synod, which was held in Yangon, Burma, from 1954 to 1956. And during this Buddhist Synod, the entire Tipitaka, the entire triple baskets, Buddhist texts were recited, and it was the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw who was the questioner, and the Venerable Mingon Sayadaw who was the answer, who recited all the texts. So, that we are that we have just started came about through a number of circumstances. First of all, it so happens that many young Israelis, especially after they've completed their military service with the army, opt to go to places such as what? Go to India. And they go there for spiritual endeavors. They're trying to find other solutions. They're trying to find other approaches to life. And in pursuing their spiritual interests, some of them also happen to come to Nepal. And it is in Nepal that the birthplace of the Buddha is located. And the birthplace is located in a small place known as Lumbini. And this is where we have a meditation center. And this is where a number of Israeli meditators have come over the years. Now, our center, the Lumbini International Meditation Center, the Vipassana Meditation Center, was inaugurated in February 1999. And so during the first few years, we had only very few Israelis. But starting last year, the number of Israeli meditators has increased tremendously. And so the surprising thing is that overall, in comparison to other nationalities of meditators who come and practice at the center, the Israelis are doing very well, exceptionally well. And this is basically the main reason that I'm here already for the second time. Last year we had a retreat in Mali Hapsor in the south of Israel, and this time it's here. And a number of the meditators Israeli meditators who've practiced in Lumbini are again here. So I'm very happy about this, and it's definitely helps for the it helps to carry out this retreat. Anyway, for a retreat like this to take place, many factors have to come together. And so one adverse, very much so adverse factor was the political situation in Nepal. And some of you may have heard or may have seen in the internet or on the news that until recently, during the month of April, there were major protests going on in Nepal. And we had a general strike for about 20 to 21 days. And at the height of this general strike, there were about 1 million protesters in Kathmandu, and many hundreds of thousands of meditators in other major cities in Nepal. And the political situation being extremely volatile, extremely dangerous, and many issues, fundamental issues, being questioned. In consultation with my teacher, I then had to cancel the first retreat for this year, namely a 1 month retreat in Italy. And this retreat was supposed to take place in April. And fortunately, the political situation improved somewhat. The general strike was called off once the king had made major concessions and had reopened parliament, and constituent assembly is in the offing. So this was one major difficulty or obstacle in to overcome in order to have this retreat. Another major obstacle was here from Galia's side. Galia had arranged for another venue for the retreat and the people connected with that place 2 weeks before the retreat called up for their commitment and said, sorry, the center is not available for security reasons. And so we ended up here. And so all of this, I'm saying all of this to just to show you how difficult it is to organize such a retreat. Many people have to work together, and it takes a lot of goodwill. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. And also, I can see from your side to let go of your commitments and to come to a retreat such as this for 10 days is not always easy. It takes many. Many arrangements. Anyway, we're here to practice. And the objective for this retreat, and especially for you, is to develop as much wisdom as possible. And okay. And so, the main objective is to develop wisdom, and wisdom which will unfold in different stages, and ultimately it will lead to the realization of Nibbana. And so, this development of wisdom requires the purification of the mind. And so, as an initial step towards this purification of the mind, the Buddha has recommended that meditators train themselves in what is known as the three trainings, namely the training in morality, sila, sila seka, the training in concentration, samadhi seka, and the training in wisdom, panya seka. For this retreat, and 10 days is actually a rather short period of time. Therefore, kindly try to make good use of your time, try to be as diligent as possible in your meditation practice, practice wholeheartedly, but please also do consider other meditators' needs, so try not to disturb them. In preparing for this retreat, I read up a little bit about Judaism, and I found one inspiring verse, namely from Psalms 16:8, saying, I keep the Lord always before me. And you will know this in Hebrew. Brings across a certain intensity. I keep the Lord always before me, at all times. And it is with this kind of intensity that we also need to practice mindfulness. So we could rephrase this sentence or this verse for our needs here and say, I keep mindfulness always before me during the next 10 days. Now, the three trainings that the Buddha has spoken of, namely the training in morality, the training in concentration, and the training in wisdom, these three trainings are needed in order to overcome what is known as the mental defilements. So, by mental defilements, we mean mental impurities. Now, unwholesome states, pollutants of the mind, certain states that make life difficult for us as well as for others. And these mental defilements we need to overcome. And we overcome them through the triple training. With sila, with a certain code of precepts, that moral or ethical precepts, and that we overcome the so-called transgressive defilements. And by transgressive defilements, in the Pali language, scriptural language, and they are known as pariyutana kilesas, are meant those defilements that actually lead to a transgression of the precepts through, you know, bodily deeds or verbal deeds. Certain ethical code, our physical and verbal behavior becomes more cultivated, more refined, and then also lovable, and it will contribute towards peaceful behavior. It is with the training in concentration, samadhi, seka, that we overcome the so-called obsessive mental defilements. And those are mental defilements that do not lead to transgressions. They happen only on a mental level, such as thoughts of wanting to torment or ill-treat or even to kill some maybe creature, some living thing, or the intention or the thought of wanting to take something that doesn't belong to oneself, and so on. And by developing concentration in the course of the meditation practice, do we manage to overcome these obsessive defilements. The transgressive defilements, apart from the obsessive defilements, there are also the so-called latent or dormant defilements. Those are mental states which lie latent or dormant in the mind, and they're not active yet. They're not manifesting in any particular way, but the potential to turn into an obsessive defilement, the potential to turn into a transgressive defilement is definitely there. And these latent defilements can be overcome only through the training in wisdom, panya seka in the Pali scriptural language. Now, among the three trainings, sila or morality is spoken of first because it is the foundation for the other two. And this sila or moral or an ethical code of conduct consists of either a set of five precepts, and this would be the absolute minimum, or otherwise there are sets of eight precepts, nine precepts, or even 10 precepts, and then the monastic vows for the monks and nuns. So by observing these precepts, or these precepts foster a basic purity which then will make progress along the path possible. The first precept is to refrain from taking life. From taking life, or otherwise from ill-treating, tormenting, hurting, or harming living beings. The second precept is about refraining, voluntarily refraining from taking what is not given. Simply put, from stealing. From stealing, from embezzlement, or any form of misappropriation. And the third among the five precepts is to refrain from unlawful sexual relations, especially to refrain from adultery. having sexual organs and entertaining sexual relations with a person other than one's spouse or one's partner. Physical conduct or morality, sila, derives from a basic sense of humanity. And suppose in a bout of rage we want to harm another being. If we put ourselves in the place of the other person, in the shoes of the other person, and we then reflect, would we like it if somebody comes and harms us? Then, obviously, the answer will be no. And just like we don't want to be harmed, others also don't want to be harmed. And so, taking ourselves as a yardstick, we then voluntarily refrain from killing or tormenting or harming other beings. Goes for the act of stealing. If one contemplates taking another person's property, before doing this, one should reflect wisely and put oneself in the shoes of, or in the position of, the owner of that so cherished property. And if one, and then one could reflect that one would not want one's own property being stolen. Just like one doesn't like one's own property being stolen, so too others will not like it either. So again, by taking oneself as a yardstick, one voluntarily refrains from any act of taking what is not given, or from stealing or embezzlement. But before indulging in an act of sexual misconduct, namely having a relationship that would hurt others, we should reflect wisely, and we should consider the damage and the psychological damage, the harm that will be done through, or that will be caused through, such an act to all the parties involved. And understanding this, one then voluntarily refrains from such an act. One doesn't like it to be lied at, to be cheated, to become a victim of false speech, so too others will not like it. If, based on some wrong information, one then takes some decision which has certain serious implications, well, one will have to face, one might have to face very negative consequences. So, just like one doesn't want to face these consequences oneself, so too others will not like it either. And understanding this out of loving kindness, metta, and compassion, karuna, one then decides to refrain from any act of wrongful speech. As for the fifth precept, which is about voluntarily refraining from taking intoxicating substances such as alcohol and drugs, one can apply the same principle as before. One takes oneself as a yardstick, and just like oneself doesn't like it to be harassed by someone who is either drunken or on drugs, so too others will not like it either. So one refrains from these substances. With regard to the fifth precept, there are also other ways of looking at it. Namely, the primary point, the Buddha's teachings, is the development of mindfulness. And this mindfulness then leading to concentration, to wisdom, and to the realization of Nibbana. And if one were to take intoxicating substances, then this would, you know, absolutely defeat one's objective. And taking intoxicating substances leads to the very opposite of mindfulness, namely to absent-mindedness or heedlessness. Yet another way of looking at this fifth precept is that when breaking the fifth precept, when indulging in intoxicating substances, one is likely also to break at least some of the other precepts. So once one is drunken, or once one is drunk, or one is high on drugs, there is a good chance that one might indulge in some unwholesome activity, and the least would be, you know, talking a lot of nonsense. All of you will be taking, if I'm not mistaken, the five precepts, no? The five precepts, and then, you know, starting from tomorrow, the eight precepts. Now, there's a slight difference with regard to the five and eight precepts in respect to the third precept. The third precept out of the five precepts is somewhat less strict, and it covers only acts of unlawful sexual relations. Whereas the third precept out of the eight precepts says that one should refrain from all sexual activities, even with one's spouse or partner while on retreat. What you do after the retreat is a different story, but while on retreat. During an intensive retreat, Vipassana retreat, it is advisable to change one's behavior in certain ways. So on retreat, noble silence becomes the appropriate form of right speech. So we refrain from any kind of conversations, you know, unnecessary conversations, except for, a discussion during the interview, except for cases when we need some advice or we need to know some practical things and need to talk to one of the staff members. Now, moderation in eating also becomes the appropriate form of eating during an intensive retreat, which means that starting tomorrow, all of you will take the eight precepts. And the sixth out of these eight precepts is the so-called Vikala Bhojana precept, which means that meditators refrain from taking solid food after midday. Now, here we're on summertime, which means then after 1 p.m. And one refrains from taking solid food from midday until the dawn of the following morning. And the reason for this is to suffer less from sleepiness and drowsiness, because it's a common experience among meditators after a meal, after breakfast, after lunch, one goes suddenly back to the meditation hall, one sits, and one ends up nodding, at least for 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
ורצינות באכילה בדרך הראויה של אכילה.
By limiting oneself to only two meals a day, namely breakfast and lunch and some juice or tea in the afternoon, one may gain some extra time for practice, and with this discover that the taste of the Dhamma by far excels the taste of dinner. The seventh precept out of the eight precepts is that of refraining from dancing, singing, then playing musical instruments, and participating in any form of entertainment. Furthermore, to refrain from using or wearing garments and using cosmetics, perfumes, and ornaments. And all of this is to not to distract oneself and also not to distract others. Dancing, singing, playing instruments. Instruments and then entertainment. So, outside of a retreat, all of these activities are okay, there's nothing to say, but during an intensive retreat, we should make necessary adjustments, and by doing so, it will help us in our meditation practice to progress quickly. The last out of the eight precepts is to refrain from the use of high luxurious seats and beds, and so this is basically meant to cut down on pride and conceit. Now, especially in an Asian context where people of a high social status would sit on high seats or would lie on luxurious beds, and so this then might lead to certain pride and conceit, and again, this is not what we aim at during intensive Vipassana meditation. I can say this much about the precepts, about an ethical code of conduct being very helpful for this training in training in wisdom or training leading to the unfolding of wisdom and the realization of Nibbana. Let us now take the five precepts. And traditionally, this is done by reciting a few lines in the Pali scriptural language, and most of you have the text, and so please repeat after me in Pali. And maybe to help you a little bit, you will find the first portion is homage, paying homage to the Enlightened One, and later on there's the portion on taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So if you have difficulties about paying homage to the Buddha or taking refuge in the Buddha, then this is no problem, and instead just focus on the Dhamma, the teachings that lead to a purification of the mind, that lead to liberation from suffering. And so when you focus on the Dhamma itself, then it becomes more impersonal, and this may then be easier for you. And out of respect for these teachings, it is a custom to clasp one's hands in front of the chest, and then take and then to recite and to take the precepts. So, if you're ready for this, then please do so. If not, never mind. So now please repeat after me. Namo dasa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa.
Namo dasa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa.
Three times. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Now the precepts, the five precepts, and the third one is slightly different from what you find on the sheets of paper. Anadipata viramani sikabadam samadhiyami. Adena dana viramani sikabadam samadhiyami. Kamesu maichachara viramani sikabadam samadhiyami. Musavada viramani sikabadam samadhiyami. Sura meraya majja pamadatana viramani sikabadam samadhiyami. Idame silam magga phala jnanasa pachaya hotu apamadina sambadita. So far we've explained about or somewhat in detail about the first training, namely the training in morality, and let us now go on to the training in concentration, samadhi seka, and just say a few words about this. By continuously exerting effort in the observation of the most predominant objects arising in the body and the mind, mindfulness arises. And when sustained for a longer period of time, the mind becomes collected, and it will then be fixed to the object of observation, or it will stick to the object of observation. Now, in the presence of concentration, samadhi in the Pali language, certain unwholesome mental states, especially the hindrances, will have no chance to arise. They will be suppressed in the mind. However, the suppression of certain mental defilements does not mean that they've been uprooted from the mind or from the stream of consciousness once and forever. So this concentration performs a certain function dispelling the mental defilements, but it's not enough. And therefore, the training in wisdom, panyaseka, is further or is necessary. When a meditator has some faith in the practice, based on this faith, then exerts effort and tries to send the mind, the observing mind, towards the object again and again, mindfulness gradually arises. When this mindfulness is present for a longer period of time, then concentration develops. And based on this concentration, then wisdom arises. And it is with wisdom that we gradually manage to, or that we manage to dispel the mental defilements that arise in the stream of consciousness, first on a temporary basis, and later on, when the necessary conditions are present, then it can come to the total eradication of those mental, of those latent or dormant mental defilements. Srila Mahasaya of Myanmar or Burma has certainly given meditation instructions that lead to the cultivation of wisdom. And so these instructions will be given from now onwards. Now, the first instructions concern especially the sitting meditation, but in principle they can also be applied to the walking meditation and mindfulness in general activities. And these instructions, they cover just everything, all of our activities during the retreat. Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on mindfulness, recommends that one find a secluded place, or that one finds, or that one sit at the root of a tree and practice meditation there. And the same Satipatthana Sutta also recommends that one sit in the lotus posture. Now, of course, not everyone here has very flexible legs, and so if it's not possible for you to sit in the full lotus posture, then this is no problem whatsoever. And please do understand, that you don't have to be a hero. There's no need to impress other meditators with sitting in the full lotus posture for maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and then you end up in agony. Important then to sit in the full lotus posture is that you can maintain, that you choose a posture which you can maintain comfortably for a longer period of time without developing some major pains and aches. And And so if the full lotus posture is too difficult for you, then consider assuming the half lotus posture. If this too proves to be too difficult, then you might assume the Burmese posture, which consists of, or which means that you place one leg in front of the other without interlocking the legs. Especially for beginning meditators, it's very helpful if you take an additional cushion or two and place it underneath your buttocks. With the buttocks slightly raised off the ground, it's much easier to sit. You'll have much less muscular tension in the thighs. From the full lotus posture or half lotus posture or the Burmese posture, you might also consider sitting on a small bench or in any other way that suits you. For those of you who have chronic back problems, let's say you've had some accident, or like myself, some slip disc now, that's why I'm sitting on a chair, please feel free to sit on a chair, but do try not to lean against the backrest, because this may easily lead to the rising of sleepiness. Also, what you could consider to maybe sit one, especially for the newcomers, to sit one sitting or to do one sitting on a chair and maybe the next one on the cushion. Have major pains or difficulties. But you can place your hands in different ways. There's no particular mudra given now by the Buddha. So you could place your hands like this, or here in the middle, or whatever is convenient for you. Next, try to keep your back as upright as possible. An upright posture very much helps to keep sleepiness and drowsiness away. And if you need to adjust your posture, please do so, but slowly and mindfully. So furthermore, as much as possible, try to sit quietly or keep your body still. Of course, in the beginning, this is going to be very difficult, and there'll be many impulses to change the posture or change the body in this way and that way. And so work on this, try to not to react on these impulses right away. And you will see after a few days that things become easier, and then you will find it easier to sit still without changing your posture all the time. There's a rationale behind this, namely, the stillness of the posture is a prerequisite for the arising of stillness in the mind. So a meditator who keeps moving and shifting and fidgeting all the time will find it very difficult to gain this stillness of mind. So in meditation, usually we keep the eyes closed during the sitting meditation. However, especially during the first few days, should you suffer from sleepiness, and then you could consider briefly opening the eyes, keeping them open for a minute or two or three, and this might help to dispel the sleepiness, and then once it's gone, you can close your eyes again and continue with your sitting. Sitting there with a still body, eyes closed, and then the breathing will be natural. By natural, we mean don't force or manipulate your breathing in any way. If after a couple of minutes of practice or so, your breathing slows down and becomes more refined, then just let it be that way. And just observe it the way it is. If, on the other hand, at times your breathing accelerates somewhat, then just accept it and observe it as it is. Now, the primary object in this Mahasi style or Mahasi tradition of Vipassana meditation is the rising movement of the abdomen and the falling movement of the abdomen. And this rising and falling movement of the abdomen serves, so to speak, as your anchor to which you come back whenever there's no other predominant object arising. And so you observe, you start at the very beginning of the sitting, you start with the observation of the rising and falling, and then if at a later point some other more predominant object arises, either in the body or in the mind, then feel free to let go of your rising and falling, move your attention to this next object, then label it, observe it, and know its nature. Once it has passed away, then go back to your primary object, namely the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And then, when observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen or any other predominant object, kindly try to stick to or keep in mind three things, three aspects. The first one is the so-called occurrence of the object. The second one is the labeling of the object and the observation, so these two go together. And the third one is the knowing, the knowing aspect, or knowing the nature of the object. Aspect, the occurrence of that object. There's nothing special you have to do. An object will occur all by itself, automatically. And the only thing, you need to know which object is there. And this point is important for also for the interviews, where you then have to report which object occurred. So you say such and such an object occurred. Sometimes it happens during the interviews that a meditator, very enthusiastic, comes in and starts reporting without ever saying which object he or she is talking about. So that's with regard to the occurrence of the object. The second aspect, the labeling of observation. Now, this requires your input. Whenever or as soon as an object has arisen, try to find a proper label for it. And so this is to be done mentally. So in the case of the rising movement of the abdomen, rising movement of the abdomen, you just label it as rising. And so in the case of the falling movement of the abdomen, you label it as falling. So it's just a word that you say mentally, but without speaking it out loud. For instance, a pain occurs, and you then start observing the pain, then you could label this as pain. Or if there's hardness somewhere, then you label this as hardness. If there's heat, you label this as heat. If there's cold somewhere in the body, you label this as cold, and so on and so forth. It's not the only thing. The labeling is, has a secondary importance. Much more important is the actual observation of the object. This means that you try to observe the rising movement of the abdomen from its very beginning through the middle until its very end. And you do the same thing for the falling movement of the abdomen. You do the same thing for any other predominant object occurring in the body or in the mind. Then the next aspect is knowing the nature of the object. This simply means that you know the different qualities of the object, or its features, or its characteristics. This is just using synonyms here. The rising movement of the abdomen occurs, and you label it as rising, you observe it from the beginning to the end, and then you find out that there is some tension there. This knowing and the tension is what is meant with the third aspect. Or while observing the rising movement of the abdomen, you find the tension, and on top of this you notice that the tension increases, or it decreases, or whatever, or it might turn into a different sensation. So know these things. Or in the case of the falling movement of the abdomen, again, it occurs, you label it as falling, you observe it carefully from the beginning to the end, and you find out that there is a release of tension, there's a relaxation, and then towards the end of the falling movement, there is a contraction. This is what is meant by knowing the nature of the object. Observing the rising falling movement of the abdomen for some time, it may happen that some thoughts arise in the mind, and the thoughts become predominant. So thoughts about home, thoughts about the things that you forgot to do before coming here, and then you might go into planning and so on and so forth. So obviously the thinking is the new object. In this case, you label it as thinking. You label it as thinking, or planning, or remembering, whatever. And then you observe this thinking, and if it disappears by itself, you come back to the rise and fall of the abdomen. If it continues, label and observe it some more, know its nature without getting lost in the content of the thoughts, and if it continues for a longer period of time, then simply cut it off and return to the observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. Observing thoughts, please don't get hooked to the content of your thinking. The content doesn't matter. What matters is that you are aware that thinking is certainly taking place. And keep in mind that thinking in the context of the past meditation is considered a hindrance to progress. So it slows you down in your meditation practice. Of course, thinking is necessary in the field of education, at the workplace, or when we're at home, when we plan things, and so on and so forth. But in the meditation practice, thinking really gets into our way. And the thinking makes it difficult to observe observe a predominant object. Once you've returned from thinking, you're back observing the rising falling movement of the abdomen, then you label, you observe, and you try to know the nature of the object, the primary object, as best as you can. And in the course of doing so, after a while, some pain might arise somewhere in the body, let's say in the knee. This pain becomes predominant. Okay, then it's time to let go of the rise and fall, and you focus, or you shift your attention onto the pain, and then you start labeling it as pain, and you observe it something carefully, and you're trying to know its nature. Now, with regard to the observation of pains and aches, there are a number of factors to be considered, and what I'm going to say now will also apply to other predominant physical objects. Namely, please try to find out the quality of the sensation. So what kind of sensation is it? What kind of pain is it? There's a whole variety of pains. It could be a stinging pain, it could be a burning pain, it could be a pain, a cutting pain, just as if one were cutting or chopping up some vegetables, and so on and so forth. to a pain or some other predominant sensation, do pay attention to its intensity. So how's this object behaving in terms of intensity? Is the intensity of the object increasing while you're observing it, or is it staying the same, or is it decreasing? And yet another aspect, somewhat related, sometimes when you're observing a pain, you may find that in the course of the observation, it turns into some other sensation. So first you have a burning pain, and then later on, it turns into vibrations, and ultimately, it disappears. Next, do also pay attention to the location factor or location aspect. How's the pain or sensation behaving in terms of location? Is it arising in one spot and then disappearing in the same spot? Or is it arising in one spot and then spreading out over a larger area? Or arising in one spot and then moving around, maybe in a zigzag manner or in a straight line or in whatever other manner. So know these different, or know the behavior of your pain. Attention to the duration of your pain or the sensation. Is it lasting only for a second and then it's gone? Or is it lasting for maybe a minute or two? Or, to the dismay of the meditator, is it lasting for many, for let's say the whole sitting? And when you work with a pain, please try not to see the pain as your enemy, and try not to practice with an attitude of to trying to get rid of this pain as quickly as possible, but rather take a pain as your friend and then try to get to know it as best as you can and observe it with an accepting attitude. Keep in mind that in Vipassana meditation, we observe the arising objects without preference. So we try to be impartial with regard to what is happening. Whether a sensation is pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't matter. If it's predominant, we just observe it. If a mental state is pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't matter. If it's predominant, we just observe it as it is. When in your meditation practice, the pain arises and it lasts for a longer period of time, naturally the impulse will arise to change one's posture. One wants to be comfortable. And try to resist this impulse, try not to give in to this impulse right away, but rather be aware of this intention to change the posture, label this, take it as an object, label it, observe it, and you might find that the intention disappears by itself and there's no need to change the posture, at least not right away. So when a pain becomes excruciating, please do feel to change your posture. So, then, and mindfully, be aware of all the different movements involved in changing your posture. One basic principle for this Vipassana meditation is to always or almost always observe the most predominant object. No, it's not, to observe one object at a time. So if you have two or three objects which are of more or less the same predominance, please feel free to choose the one of your liking. And then stay with it, label it, observe it, and try to know its nature. And to observe two or three or even more objects at the same time will make it very difficult to know the details with regard to one object. And concentration has to be split over several objects, and as a result of it, you will not know very much about the different objects. Important principle or maxim is always label, observe, and know the most predominant object occurring in the body or in the mind. So, applied to the practice, this means that once the pain has disappeared and you're finished or you're done observing the pain, and then return to your rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And you observe this for a while, and then if some predominant mental state arises, such as restlessness, when you take the restlessness as your next object, you label it as such, you're feeling restless or being restless, and then you observe it carefully, you try to know what this feels like in the mind, and maybe also how this manifests in the body, and then once restlessness has disappeared, and then you go back to your rising and falling movement of the abdomen.
זה שאנחנו תמיד היה איזשהו מצב מנטלי, לדוגמה, אי שקט, אז אנחנו לוקחים
great variety of mentalness states. And at the very beginning you will come across just a few, later on you'll come across many more. You'll discover many, sometimes even new mental states which are new to you, such as equanimity, or you'll get an idea of what wisdom is all about, and so on and so forth. So whenever such a mental state is predominant, be it positive or negative, wholesome or unwholesome, skillful or unskillful, just label it, observe it, and know it. The principle of always observing the most predominant object applies something to the same stores. So, if we happen to see some predominant object internally, see a predominant object during the sitting meditation, or otherwise an external object during the walking meditation or general activities, and then we take this as a predominant, we take this as an object of observation, we label it as such, namely as seeing, and then we observe it carefully, and then we try to know its nature. Likewise for the hearing process, should we perceive some loudness sound and it attracts our attention, then we label this as hearing. We observe it certainly carefully and we try to know its nature. Once the sound is gone, then it's back to the rising and falling movement, observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And the same principle then applies to the other sense doors. So, to the nose door, the tongue door, and the body door, and mental states, the mind door. In the meditation practice, the most vital or most crucial factor is the continuity of one's mindfulness. And it's difficult to, especially in the beginning of a retreat or one's meditation practice, to see this point. But the more you practice, the more you will understand. And therefore, in your meditation practice, try to be as continuous as possible in your mindfulness. So, you're mindful of the rising movement of the abdomen, of the falling movement of the abdomen, then there's some wandering mind, you're mindful of this, then there is some pain, you're mindful of it, then there may be some mental state like the restlessness, again you're mindful of it without wandering off. And of course in the course of one day there'll be gaps in your mindfulness, and you will know best when those gaps occur, and try to fill those gaps. And so maybe, for instance, when you're brushing your teeth and you're not really mindful, and then simply you stop the activity and then you start again, but this time with proper labeling and proper observation. Apart from mindfulness and continuous mindfulness, there are other mental factors that also very much contribute to good practice. And those are, number one, aiming. So a particular object of observation arises, and the mind needs to be aimed or focused, properly aimed at the object of observation. If the aiming is not correct, then how can we know the nature of the object? Self is not enough. One also needs effort. Effort to propel or to send the observing and knowing mind towards the object of observation. And this effort needs to be there, not just once in a sitting, not just twice in a sitting, but from moment to moment to moment to moment. So ideally throughout the entire sitting. And if these two factors are present, namely aiming and effort, then automatically the mind will be touching the object, rubbing the object. And out of this, in the presence of aiming, of effort, of rubbing, and mindfulness, then quite naturally concentration will arise, and based on this wisdom will unfold. This much regarding the sitting meditation. Now, what has been said, you can also apply to the walking meditation. And as an implication of the continuity of mindfulness, it follows that meditators should continue to be mindful during other activities apart from the sitting meditation. So, walking meditation and during the general activities. And the Venerable Mahasi Sada has recommended that, or has spoken of, three forms of walking meditation. The first one being the somewhat faster walking meditation, which is still pretty slow in comparison to ordinary walking. And the second, and with this, you just label as left step, right step. So whenever the left leg moves, you label as left step, and then you observe the most predominant sensation in the leg, wherever it arises. And when the right leg moves, you label this as right step, and you observe the most predominant sensation in the leg. And the second, after a sitting of 1 hour, you get up, and then you could first do this first form of walking meditation, so somewhat faster. This might help you to release some of the bodily stiffness. And then, after doing this first type of walking meditation for maybe 10 minutes or 20 minutes, then you change to the second kind of walking meditation, which is already slower, and in this form, you divide one step into two parts, namely the lifting of the foot and the lowering plus the placing of the foot. So when you lift the foot, you label this as lifting, then you observe the different sensations that occur during the lifting process, you know these sensations, and then while you're lowering and placing the foot again, you label this and you try to know the different sensations involved. So after 20 minutes of the first type of walking meditation, then you change to the more slower form, which consists of the lifting and placing, and then you do 20 minutes of this, and then you do the third type of walking meditation for another 20 minutes, which is much slower. It's the slowest among the three, and you divide one step into three parts, namely the lifting process, which is as explained before, then the moving process and the lowering process. Now, lowering process also has been explained already, and the moving portion is not very different. At the very beginning of the moving process, you label as moving, and then carefully you observe this forward movement of the foot, and you try to know the different sensations that occur in the foot, or you try to be aware of the type of movement. Sometimes it can be a continuous movement, or at times you might find that it is a stop and go movement, a discontinuous movement, so on. Or you might find, especially in the beginning, that it's difficult to maintain the balance, so you might lose your balance. Whatever it might be, just be aware of it. The forms of walking meditation will be demonstrated tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and tonight we don't have the time for this. Two more main points regarding the walking meditation, but also regarding the general activities, namely, try to slow down your walking meditation and general activities as much as you can. There is another maxim here: the slower you do the various activities, the more progress you will have, the faster you will progress in your meditation practice, and not the other way around. The other point also concerning the walking meditation as well as general activities is the restraint of the senses. So even you have eyes to see with and ears to hear with and a nose to smell with, yet try to restrain your senses as much as possible. And in the beginning this may seem somewhat awkward and you may not like it too much, but in the end, this restraint of the senses very much helps to develop concentration, and based on this, then to develop wisdom. The general activities, it's the same thing. Just try to be as mindful as possible in whatever you're doing from the moment you wake up in the morning until the moment you fall asleep at night. And so it governs activities such as opening the eyes, closing the eyes, then getting out of bed, getting ready, taking a shower, and then coming to the meditation hall, and after sitting, there'll be the breakfast, so try to be mindful while eating, and when you have to use the bathroom, be mindful of the different activities involved. When you do your laundry, just about everything needs to be done with mindfulness. Now, this brings us to the end of the instructions, and so as mentioned earlier, there will be more tomorrow morning from 9 o'clock onwards. And let me conclude today's Dhamma talk, this opening talk, by wishing that may all of you apply these instructions as diligently as possible, and And then in the course of this 10-day retreat, may you progress as swiftly as possible, and may wisdom unfold, may this practice bring you closer and closer to the attainment, and to closer to the attainment of Nibbana and the actual attainment of it, and may it thus bring purity into your mind, into your life, and also much peace. And this is it for tonight.